This is the takeaway for Monday, August 3rd, 2015. This is the takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The bold Obama summer of 2015 continues.
Climate change is not a problem for another generation, not anymore. That's why on Monday, my administration will release the final version of America's Clean Power Plan, the biggest, most important step we've ever taken to combat climate change.
Slickly produced White House video there announcing that one of the big setbacks of the Obama administration, the cap and trade approach to climate change, is actually back in what's now being called, you heard the president say it there, the Clean Power Plan. Under the newly finalized plan, the EPA will enforce a shift to a higher percentage of renewable energy generation capacity by 2030, with straight ahead regulations and goals for states to meet through federal incentives. States that move quickly to decommission old fossil fuel power plants and bring online renewable energy sources will receive federal aid. The goal is to get the energy industry to move in the same direction. Here's EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy.
Some special interest critics will tell you that it can't be done. They'll say we have to focus on the economy at the expense of the environment. They'll tell you EPA's plan will turn the lights off and send utility bills through the roof, but they are wrong.
In fact, the EPA estimates say that under this plan, electricity bills for U.S. consumers will drop by an average of $85 a year in 2030. That's a long way off. Stephanie Joyce joins us now, energy and natural resource reporter for Wyoming Public Radio and Inside Energy. Welcome, Stephanie.
Hi, John. Thank you for having me.
So that's, far off in the distant future, but this is really a local story there in Wyoming, a co-producing state. How is this being treated by organizations and institutions in Wyoming?
This is definitely a local issue here in Wyoming. This rule obviously has the potential to shut down a large percentage of existing coal-fired power plants and freeze construction of new ones. And those power plants are the customers for Wyoming coal. Wyoming is the largest coal-producing state in the nation. And the projections vary for how much this could impact the state. But some of the worst ones show coal production in the state declining up to 60%. So it's a very controversial issue here in Wyoming. People here don't even really like to use the name of the regulation, the Clean Power Plan. Instead, they call it 111D, after the section of the Clean Air Act that it relies on. So here in Wyoming, there aren't going to be very many people celebrating today.
Do you think these regulations will survive court challenges that are likely? And there have already been some court challenges on some of the aspects of this plan that was hinted at a year ago.
There have already been lawsuits against the plan. 14 states, including Wyoming, sued over the draft rule. That lawsuit was thrown out because you can't sue over a draft. But there will certainly be more lawsuits as soon as this rule is published in the Federal Register. I think we can expect to see a number of states and industry suing over the rule. Whether they're successful or not, I think, is a matter of quite a bit of debate. There are lawyers arguing over that as we speak. But whether or not the law is overturned, it's been a line in the sand. You know, it's made coal risky, and utility companies are typically very risk averse. So I think we'll see them moving away from it, really regardless of what ends up happening in the legal challenges.
How do you think these incentives, as the EPA has put forth in this proposal, and that we'll hear more about all this week, how are they going to overcome the political pushback here? You have Mitch McConnell really mobilizing governors to resist in state houses the implementation of these measures.
Yeah, these the final incentives that the Obama administration put into the rule include pushing back the deadline for compliance. Initially, states had been asked to start complying with the rules by 2020. In the final rule, that's pushed back to 2022, which should give states a little bit more time to come up with a plan for reducing emissions, make investments in some of the renewables that they're being asked to make investments in. Critics were also concerned about reliability before the rule came out, keeping the lights on. You know, they said shutting down coal-fired power too quickly could lead to brownouts and blackouts. And there is a safety valve in the final rule that will allow states to address that. And in addition to that longer compliance date. But the other incentives, the Obama administration has said they will actually provide credits to states for for constructing more renewables before that 2022 deadline. And they will provide incentives to states for giving energy efficiency improvements to low-income communities. And we'll see whether those assuage the critics at all. I have a feeling that they probably will not. The most vocal critics are from coal-producing states and states that rely heavily on coal for generating power. And those critics are probably not going to change their mind given the incentives in the new rule.
Very quickly before we go, do you think carbon as a pollutant as in the EPA's regulations will remain a principle here, or will that get thrown out?
Whether carbon as a pollutant will remain in the final regulations is almost certain. Carbon is being treated as a if you listen to Obama's release video from over the weekend, you'll hear him talk about carbon in the same sentence as mercury and other hazardous pollutants that we already regulate here in the United States. So carbon will certainly continue to be treated as a pollutant in the final rule.
Carbon will stay. Stephanie Joyce, energy and natural resource reporter for Wyoming Public Radio and Inside Energy. Thanks so much, Stephanie.
Thank you, John.
When the product you sell, energy, is produced by burning coal and oil and declared dirty by the federal government, you might have a few things to say about that. Joining us now is Tom Pyle, president of the American Energy Alliance. Tom Pyle, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
First of all, what is the American Energy Alliance exactly?
We're a nonprofit organization. We focus on free market energy policies, analyze public policy, and engage citizens to participate in the political process.
And are you opposed to these regulations and these changes, the goals set by the administration?
Very much so, yes.
And why would you be opposed to sustainable energy that will reduce the deposit of carbon into the atmosphere?
Well, that's not really the question. We're not opposed to renewable energy. We're opposed to rules and regulations that are, in the case of this rule, probably likely to be invalidated by the courts. Go way beyond what was envisioned by the Clean Air Act. And finally, and most importantly, will harm ratepayers. And we all know that we all pay for energy, but the ones who are the poorest among us and those on fixed incomes get hit the hardest by energy price increases.
On what basis will the courts overrule this?
Well, we think that the EPA is overreaching here. And the way they've set this up is they're trying to get the states to basically validate the changes that they've proposed, or the quote-unquote flexibility that they're offering states, is really just an attempt to get the states to do the EPA's dirty work.
Although it is the case that the EPA sets regulations that the states have to meet.
Sure. And in most cases, they have followed, largely anyway, the constructs of the law. But in this case, they've gone far beyond what anything ever imagined the Clean Air Act to do.
But the Clean Air Act was passed at a time when climate change wasn't imagined at all, and the kinds of problems that we're dealing with today in terms of clean air are very different from what was the case in the 70s.
But that doesn't give the EPA the right to circumvent the law. I mean, the larger issue here is the rule itself, EPA's own models suggest that temperature increases will be halted and potentially reduced by 0.018 degrees Celsius. And if you're talking about sea level rise, they're talking about preventing the rise of the seas to the tune of approximately 3 sheets of paper. So there's really no benefit to this rule either if the goal is to reduce global average temperatures.
The American Energy Alliance is funded by the coal industry and the Koch brothers. Is that not the case?
We receive our funding from individuals, foundations, and corporations, including energy companies. But again, I don't know that that's relevant to the discussion. Just like, say, the NRDC, who gets their funding from people who invest in renewables, should or shouldn't be relevant to the discussion.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that is there any scenario under which reduction of coal burning would be endorsed by the Koch Industries companies or the coal industry at large?
I can't speak to either because I don't represent either of them. But I will say this. If you have a surging natural gas production in this country and natural gas is a viable alternative to producing electricity and it has resulted in many cases a reduction in CO2, then yeah, the answer is the market is the answer for that. I'm not saying that we shouldn't burn coal. I'm a huge fan of coal. I think it has done more good for the world than any of the downsides of it combined. And more people around the world are going to continue to use more and more coal because it provides electricity, which is the driver of human progress.
Right, but aren't we past this moment of driver of human progress, burn coal, electricity is the industrial might? We really have to think in a completely different way about these things because you can't just have unlimited human progress and have an environment that is healthy. I mean, just look at Beijing.
Right, and look at the United States. Wealthy is healthy. And I will tell you this, I've traveled in countries like India and I've seen villages where women still make cow patties to heat their homes and cook their food, and I'll bet you those towns and villages would love to replace those dirty sources of fuel and food with coal, and that's just the fact. I mean,
right. Well, you're just making the argument for reducing coal spending, coal burning, because you're just saying, all right, there are things that are dirtier than coal. That doesn't help you at all. I mean, yeah, India's got a problem, but that doesn't argue for us to continue to burn coal like, burning livestock fuel patties.
Okay, so why would we produce a rule that terminates existing power plants that produced low-cost, affordable, reliable electricity deliberately? Let them run their course.
If it's premature, when do you think the moment would be ripe for this to happen?
The moment is when the market sorts out the winners and the losers in the energy space, and that's really had produced tremendous benefits, both in terms of affordability and reliability of electricity. Oh, and by the way, we've got a clean environment in this country.
Tom Pyle is president of the American Energy Alliance, based in Washington, D.C. Tom, thanks so much.
Sure.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Planned Parenthood, the victim of an ideologically motivated undercover sting operation, is facing the charge that it is illegally selling fetal body tissue as a sideline to conducting legal abortions. Four undercover videos released by a group calling itself the Center for Medical Progress has put Planned Parenthood on the defensive. And today the Senate will vote once again on defunding it, threatening the about $500 million federal dollars Planned Parenthood receives each year. Joining us now is Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, how likely is this to actually come to fruition, the defunding?
Well, today, not likely at all. The vote today is likely to fail. It was cobbled together relatively quickly, and there are enough senators to deny those 60 votes, some of them Republicans. Susan Collins is one. She's the moderate Republican from Maine who said she's very concerned about the videos. The statements and the context of those videos disturb her, except that Planned Parenthood is the primary health care provider for women in lots of rural areas of her own state. Don't forget, Planned Parenthood provides not just abortions, John, but lots of other healthcare services, including cancer screenings, birth control, in some cases, breast exams and other services as well. The federal funding that you're talking about, you might be wondering, well, gee, I thought there's no federal funding allowed for abortion. That's illegal. And that's true. That federal funding that Planned Parenthood does get is siphoned into those other healthcare services. Abortion money has to be kept separate legally. This vote today, very unlikely to reach 60, but that's not the last you're going to hear of it because, first of all, there are more videos scheduled. The Center for Medical Progress promises that it has 8 to 10 more videos to fuel the fire around this controversy, and they're going to be timed in late August and September, I think. And the reason for that, John, is that there's a big spending fight coming up in September that's much bigger than this issue. How to fund the federal government? Republicans and Democrats are already clashing over sequestration, overall spending levels, over $1 trillion worth, a massive spending fight. And now conservatives in both the Senate and, more importantly, in the House are starting to up the pressure on their own leadership to include a defunding effort in that debate. Now you're talking about a Planned Parenthood abortion rider in an overall spending debate. And we've seen that movie before. That's the kind of debate that tends to derail a spending negotiation if there even is one, making it more difficult even than it is on the grounds of money for the federal government. And that increases the chances, I'm sorry to say, of a government shutdown.
So government shutdown aside for the moment, are these Planned Parenthood videos likely to simply exacerbate a sense of distastefulness associated with an activity that has a sanction in the medical community that has already been approved within the medical community? Or is it going to show Planned Parenthood crossing some huge line here that conceivably disqualifies it as an organization from receiving any federal dollars at all?
I don't know, but it seems that the question of disqualification seems unlikely. There have been many efforts in the past to defund Planned Parenthood. That isn't new. We'll have to see what the other videos say. And indeed, some Democratic candidates, and let's talk about candidates to keep in mind that we are in an election season, and that's important here. That is part of the backdrop. Hillary Clinton herself, who's an ardent supporter of abortion rights and of Planned Parenthood, said she was disturbed by the videos. Planned Parenthood has been doing a great deal of pushback. They say these videos are heavily edited. They're out of context. They've asked the National Institutes of Health to convene an independent scientific panel to find the overall health care benefits for women of funding Planned Parenthood. And they've been pushing back in the states of senators who are up for re-election, running ads in Indiana. Joe Donnelly's a moderate Democrat. He's anti-abortion. Planned Parenthood is putting up ads pro-women's health saying, Donnelly, don't vote for this thing.
Abortion, Planned Parenthood, and the latest election cycle. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thank you.
You got it, John.
Out of context, this video of Dr. Mary Gatter, president of the Medical Directors Council of Planned Parenthood, looks very much like a creepy auction for the tissue of aborted fetuses.
What would work for you? Don't lowball it.
Okay.
Tell me what you really...
$75 a specimen over a creepy soundtrack. Can this be anything else, though? We know that these videos were taken after Planned Parenthood officials were lured into a meeting where this issue of selling fetal specimens came up. What are the guidelines here, though, and who gets paid in a situation like this? Joining us is Alta Sharo, professor of law and bioethics at the University of Wisconsin Law and Medical Schools. Alta, is there a norm here, academically or medically speaking?
Yes, and in fact, there's actually federal law as well as cultural and professional norms. And specifically, since the 1990s, it has been perfectly legal to transfer fetal tissue for research purposes from legally aborted fetuses, provided you are doing it for no more than the cost of reimbursing the expenses that are involved in obtaining, transferring, and maintaining it in a safe condition.
So the idea that anyone would be profiting off of this is completely illegal and not necessarily what we would conclude from looking at these videos based on the numbers used.
Yes, there's a subtlety here, which is that the federal law's language refers only to tissue taken for transplantation purposes. That's because that is the kind of research going on at the time the law was being drafted. So technically, research that is just taking place in a laboratory doesn't even fall under these laws that restrict payment for profit. But in most cases, the entities, including Planned Parenthood, will nonetheless follow the spirit of the federal law.
And if we're talking about fetal tissue itself, is it donated? In other words, is the fact that it is from an aborted fetus automatically mean that it is available to doctors for this kind of use, or does the mother of the aborted fetus have to donate or specifically grant consent here?
The pregnant woman has to give consent, but there's a catch. She has to have already made the decision to have an abortion. Only after she's made that decision can she be asked to give consent to donate the remains, the idea being to completely separate those two things and in no possible way to influence her decision about whether to go to term with the pregnancy.
So if we were to look at this situation with Planned Parenthood from a pure public relations standpoint and a norms and legal standpoint, is there any overlap here, or are they two just completely different situations, one profoundly negative for Planned Parenthood, it would seem, and the other maybe not so much?
I think they are very separate. I think that the imagery is very disturbing. Of course, the imagery from any kind of surgical procedure or the use of a cadaver or remains is always going to be disturbing, and it's a way of highlighting for people the discomfort they have around any kind of tissue from a deceased human, fetal, newborn, or adult. And it certainly helps to further stigmatize abortion in the public's mind. But as a matter of law, and frankly, as a matter of ethics, there is no problem with using the remains from a legal abortion, no more than there's a problem using tissues and organs from the victims of a homicide. We take advantage of what we can, regardless of the underlying act.
Part of what I'm hearing you say is it's important for people to understand the reality of the situation medically, that these decisions should not be made completely in an opaque atmosphere where nobody can see what's going on. But for the video like this and for the images to get out purely in a political context to take down Planned Parenthood, that maybe is not the best case scenario.
Well, certainly one could argue that this is a debate that is not really about fetal tissue research, and that this has simply become an avenue into the more general debate around abortion and around the funding of Planned Parenthood, which, by the way, provides abortion as a tiny proportion of its services, but nonetheless is associated with it in the public's mind. But it's valuable to remember that it's this same kind of imagery that made fetal tissue research controversial in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. It resulted in at least two federal advisory committees that both concluded it should be legal and that it was ethical, provided that the donation decision was separate from the abortion decision. And one of those committees was actually chaired by a Republican opponent of abortion rights, who is a federal judge, and led that committee to an 18-3 decision to approve of this kind of research. And that was under President Reagan.
Alta Sharrow is professor of law and bioethics at the University of Wisconsin Law and Medical Schools. Thanks so much, Alta.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Tell me why I don't like.
Is Monday your worst day of the week? Best? If you look forward with Monday and the whole week ahead of you, it might seem pretty dreary. But looking back at Monday from Friday on the eve of another summer weekend, you think, hey, that wasn't so bad.
I don't care if Monday's black, Tuesday, Wednesday, hard to tell. Thursday, never looking back, it's Friday, I'm in love.
This now you see it, now you don't bad day is the theme and actual word structure of a poem that has captured internet attention for people who apparently begin their day by Googling the words worst day ever.
Today was the absolute worst day ever.
A poem entitled Worst Day Ever, written by a New York City high school student, sounds like a typical teenage I'm fed up to hear rant.
Today was the absolute worst day ever. And don't try to convince me that there's something good in every day. Because when you take a closer look, this world is a pretty evil place.
But when you read it backwards, line by line, the words cleverly flip their meaning to become an always look on the bright side meditation.
Today was a very good day, and you'll never in a million years hear me say, it's all beyond my control. My attitude creates the reality.
This poem began as part of a school assignment, but we took the liberty through the magic of audio processing of allowing you to simultaneously experience the bad day and the wisdom of finding good in everything.
Today was the absolute worst day ever.
Today was a very good day.
And don't try to convince me that there's something good in every day.
And you'll never in a million years hear me say.
Because when you take a closer look,
it's all beyond my control.
This world is a pretty evil place.
My attitude,
even if
creates
some goodness does shine through once in a while.
The reality,
satisfaction and happiness don't last.
I'm sure you can agree that. It's not true that good exists.
It's all in the mind and heart.
Only if one's surroundings are good.
Because
true happiness can be attained.
Only if one's surroundings
because
are good.
It's all in the mind and heart.
It's not true that good exists.
Satisfaction and happiness don't last.
I'm sure you can agree that.
Some goodness does shine through once in a while.
The reality,
even if
creates
this world is a pretty evil place.
My attitude.
Because when you take a closer look,
it's all beyond my control.
There's something good in every day.
And you'll never, in a million years, hear me say,
today was the absolute worst day ever. And don't try to convince me that.
Today was a very,
very good
day.
Hani Gorkin will be a senior this fall at Beth Rivka High School in Brooklyn's Crown Heights neighborhood. For Hani, finding a way to take her Orthodox Jewish teachings and have them connect with hundreds of thousands of non-Jews online has been exciting and a little daunting.
We learn Hasidic philosophy in school, and it really inspires me. According to Hasidic philosophy, everything in this world has a little bit of good in it. Nothing is completely evil.
So as you were putting this together, did you have the idea that if you turned the poem around, you'd be able to change people's outlook as you were constructing the poem?
Yeah, I had that in mind.
So what did you want people to be able to do? To read it one way and then say, all right, turn it around and read it another way.
I wanted people to be able to get a visual idea of how you could actually turn things around and by physically putting it down on paper and showing how literally the words could be changed and the whole attitude of the poem could be changed. I wanted to show how in life you could do the same with your mind.
When did you put it online?
After I wrote it, I showed it to my mother, and she really liked it. So she shared it with a few people, and then she submitted it into the Poetry Nation contest. So that, it took a while for the contest to happen, and I got a letter that I was a semifinalist in the contest, but I didn't win the contest.
But when it was tweeted out, it got lots and lots of responses from people. How many times would you say it's been looked at or downloaded or read?
I honestly have no idea.
I mean, it's more than 1.3 million.
Whoa.
I mean, do you think they're viewing it because of the cleverness? Or do you think they're viewing it because of the deeper message?
I'm not sure. I think that the idea that it could be read both ways got a lot of people. I don't know if people read deeper into it than that. I hope that people did.
So what's it like to be suddenly a very public figure?
It's pretty overwhelming. Not so comfortable with this attention. But I guess, according to my poem, I should look for the good in everything. So if it brightens other people's days around the world, then I'm happy about that.
Here's a hard one then. What do you think the Talmud would say about your responsibility suddenly that you have the attention of 1.3 million people?
Well, you're supposed to, if you're put in a place where you're able to influence people in a positive way, then you're supposed to take that opportunity to influence people as much as you have the ability to. And there's obviously a reason that I was put in this position, so I'm going to try to have a good effect on others.
Well, that's great. And, you're not a big user of social media, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Could you make an argument for my kids that maybe there's a benefit to not doing social media all the time?
Sure. Well, I get to spend time with my real friends in real life. I get to actually see their faces and get to know them without having that screen blocking us. And I just enjoy it a lot better. I don't feel the need for social media.
Well, honey, congratulations. And I guess you don't necessarily want to do something to top this, but where are you headed after 12th grade?
I don't really have any plans yet. I haven't made any decisions yet, but I'll always have writing.
Honey Gorkin, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Some goodness does shine through once in a while.
The reality,
even if,
creates,
this world is a pretty evil place.
My attitude.
Because when you take a closer look,
it's all beyond my control.
There's something good in every day.
And you'll never, in a million years, hear me say,
today was the absolute worst day ever. And don't try to convince me that.
Today was a
very good day.
Whether it's the worst day ever or one of the best, we've all got poetry to get us through. Tell us about that perfectly timed power poem that stayed with you.
Hey guys, this is Taylor from St. Louis. The best poem I ever got that's special to me was from my ex-husband about 20 years ago. I'll never forget it. It's burned in my brain. Roses are red, violets are blue. I'm not a poet, not even for you. We're divorced now. He is my ex-husband.
Jack from Red Bank. My favorite poem is The Need to Win by Zhang Zhu. Short and very to the point. Very eloquent reminder about what happens when you do things for the wrong motivation.
John from Fenton, Missouri says Mother to Son by Langston Hughes. Life to me ain't been no crystal stair. The strength in the voice of a worn-out, tired mother saying, fight on. Join the conversation. Send us your power poem by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE. Much more at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like networking, nutrition, and ninja training. Curious.com, grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.